Part 23, Chapter 9. Johnny quietly and efficiently neatened up his scene. In case anything happened to him, which he felt was more than likely in this American raid, he carefully briefed Angus in all the intricacies of the console. He made copious notes especially for Angus, so that he could duplicate and operate such a console. He told him some of the things that could be done with it. Angus objected violently to Johnny's going on the raid. Johnny said he was not going to risk anyone else's life, for the actions he had to take were too dicey. He would have the backup of 30 Scots, 10 drivers, and 15 pilots. Angus was still trying to protest, but it didn't do any good. If Robert the Fox had been there, the two of them might have prevailed, but Sir Robert was over in America, moving the academy, and Angus gave in, reluctantly. A Scot aide of Sir Robert's was there, and Johnny briefed him on the military aspects of their situation. The visitors were waiting for something. He was not sure what. Johnny felt it had to do with whether or not they got a transshipment rig operating. An analysis of their chatter among themselves showed they were observing the American compound, waiting for something to happen. The visitors had seen cyclos there, probably Turl and Kerr, and seemed to think the American scene might still be in cyclo hands, or in any event, might be political. Johnny expected the sky to fall in right after that transshipment rig was fired, and an alert should be out then for day 92, which was approaching very quickly. Johnny briefed another Scot officer and arranged a decoy platform to be hastily built in the Singapore area. There was a mine site there northwest of the ancient, deserted man city where the cyclos had mined tin, titanium, and tungsten. It had full hydroelectric power, atmosphere armor, and a certain amount of stores and planes left in it. A handful of Chinese, 3 pilots, a communicator, a coordinator, and this officer were to lay out a platform and poles. Johnny gave them the old burned-out console, which they repainted. Under the protection of the cable, they were to make like they were busy firing, complete with things appearing and disappearing on the platform. When the flights left the American area with the real console, the heaviest part of the escort would streak to the Singapore area and pull any pursuit of the real console away. The Kariba platform had been under camouflage nets from the beginning, and chatter from the visitors showed they thought it was a temple. He warned the officer that the attack would be heavy there in the Singapore area. But the Scot just smiled and grabbed his allocated men and left. Johnny made a fast tour of Kariba. The Chinese had done wonderfully well. There was a roof under the screen but over the firing platform, all held together with wooden pegs. Swooping gables and points made it very artistic. They had a lot of dragons around, carved from wood and cast in clay that pointed out from the beam ends with flaming mouths and scaly tails. They had bunkers inside the protected cone. They all had tiled interiors. They even had a little hospital. Their own village was inside the protective cable over by the lakeshore. It was all very colorful and attractive, more like a garden than a war area. Dr. Allen had gotten some juice of plants from up in the old Nairobi area. He called it pyrethrum, that killed insects very efficiently. And despite the number of animals in the woods thereabouts that attracted flies, they had had no trouble with tsetse sleeping sickness. Johnny heard them singing and playing on strange string and wind instruments that evening, so he recorded a lot of it and had them rig loudspeakers ready to play it when they activated the area. It would foul up any listening beams from upstairs. That, plus the interference the armor cable posed, would keep them ignorant of what was going on here. When he returned to the African compound, it was day 87. He found Stormalong there with more disks that showed the color codes of the cables and the pole wires. They could simply hack off the console's cables and reconnect them at Kariba. He gave the code to Angus. Stormalong said this would be his last run, so Johnny briefed him carefully on the military situation. It was Johnny's belief that the visitors would attack in force after any American firing. Stormalong had better be prepared to take control of air defenses on the planet. Johnny would not let him go on the raid. Dunedain was handling air cover for them on that. Thor would be with them in the raiding party. Johnny missed Robert the Fox, who usually handled these briefings and actions. Stormalong, like Angus, did not want Johnny to go. He said America was stripped now. The Academy was empty. Johnny would have only his own raiding party, and though he knew it had been drilled within an inch of the participants' lives, there were an awful lot of Brigantes over there. Just after they had pulled the recorders out of the three places at the Academy, Brigantes had begun to systematically loot the place. But with no Sir Robert to support his objections, Stormalong did not prevail. Johnny was going up to an upper level of the compound, and he ran into Kerr. The Cyclo Midget was all smiles. They swatted paws. He had been looking for Johnny to show him the silly money they were now printing for America and in which he had been paid. Johnny pulled him into a deserted office and shook his head over the 100-credit note and the picture of Brown Limper Staffer.
"This stuff is worthless," said Kerr. "The Brigantes just throw it into the street."
Kerr was so happy to be out of that area. He told Johnny all about it.
"And he offered me 750,000 galactic credits that I'll never see. He's one crazy cyclo, not sane like us half-humans."
Kerr laughed over that. Kerr gave him the final layouts of the firing platform area. There was nothing new. Kerr had dug and done exactly according to plan. It was the same plan on which his raiding team had been drilled, and Kerr assured him everything was in place. But Kerr hadn't realized Johnny was going over there. When he heard that, he got very serious.
"This churl is a very bad one. He's liable to have surprises. I don't like your going, Johnny."
Johnny said he had to go.
"What if you get a Cyclo War Party back on that platform in return?"
"I don't think we will. And we have a present for Cyclo."
"I hope so. It's my furry neck if they ever turn up here again. The IBI would take days to kill me."
"I don't think you have anything to worry about. But you stay here among these defenses. There's quite a few enemy prisoners in the place and all the cyclos that are left. Maybe you can teach them to play cards."
Kerr laughed. And then he said,
"Did the one you call Sir Robert come back here?"
"Why?"
"Well, right in the middle of the Academy move to England, we didn't see him anymore. I wanted to check a couple of points with him, and I couldn't find him. And Dunedain put in calls. He isn't in Edinburgh or Luxembourg or Russia. I thought he must be here. The reason I ask is he knows all your dispositions of forces and even some of your raid details."
Johnny was very concerned about Sir Robert. He threw off Kerr's question with,
"They could never make him talk."
"The IBI could make anybody talk."
"We don't know the enemy has him,"
said Johnny. Shortly afterward, he instituted his own queries. There was no sign of Sir Robert in any area. A couple of ferry planes had gone down lately from enemy attack. They had been en route from America to Scotland. Had Sir Robert been on one of them? Sir Robert had not handled many of the details of this raid. There was no reason to change planning this late. Johnny spent his last day at the Lake Victoria mine site, neatening up what there was of his personal life. He was under no illusion that this raid was not dangerous. He wrote a letter to Chrissy that he knew the parson would read for her, and put it in plain sight on his desk, the envelope marked,
"To Chrissy, in case of something happening to me."
He had heard one wrote wills to leave personal possessions. He started one. All he had was his horses and some odds and ends of clothes. He couldn't think of anything else he owned. Then he thought maybe Chrissy had occupied the Edinburgh house in his name. So he put down any interest he had in that or its contents and left it to Chrissy. Then he remembered he had a few books, so he left those to Patty. For the life of him, he couldn't recall anything else he owned. But maybe people would think he owned gifts, like the chrome AK-47. They weren't very many. Still, they might be. So he added a clause.
And anything else I am found to own shall be equally divided among...
And he listed the names of those men who had been closest to him. He thought for a while, and then added, Kerr. He had also heard that you signed these things and got them witnessed, so he did that. Then he put it in an envelope and put it alongside the letter to Chrissy. Feeling he had made things very orderly, he spent that evening making sure all his weapons and gear worked, that his radiation suit had no holes in it, that his air mask tanks were full, and that half a dozen kill clubs were in throwing condition. He put copies of the latest sales contract Turl had signed into his pouch. He checked the beryllium bomb case for safe carrying. He tested the edge of a hatchet to cut console cables. He felt he was ready and got a good sleep on his last night before the American raid. He had done everything he could. Now it was in the hands of the gods, or a devil, like Turl.